T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Jonah Carey.
Hey, great to see you.
Me too. I don't know who you are, but it's great to see you.
The Athletic and the Opener Podcast.
He's thrown his pillow, he's thrown his nightcap, and Yuppie's been thrown out of the ball game.
Tim Raines enthusiast.
Tim Raines, yeah! Welcome to the Hall of Fame. Tim was rock solid playing.
Is that right, you was?
Jonah Carey with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Jonah Carey is on Twitter at Jonah Carey. He writes for The Athletic. You hear him on Sportsnet, the Opener Podcast. He joins us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. Hello, Jonah. How are you?
I'm still waiting for my free Alpamonte Ford. I want it. I feel like I've put in enough hours already. Let's go.
What are you looking for? Like someone with some room, something that can haul?
No, I want a pickup truck. I want something that's a utilitarian.
Oh, wow. All right, cool.
It's an F-150. Yeah. An F-150 stat.
F-150, sweet, man. That's a nice ride.
The Cubs are only 2 games out of the loss column after they go and they get well against that really execrable Florida Marlins team. Is it okay for them to feel better about themselves even though they were bum-slaying?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The Marlins truly are atrocious. But look, Quintana and Hamels are pitching better, and that's good to see. And, you know, you look for other stuff, too. You're looking for swinging strike rate and called strikes and can command and going deep into games, and all that stuff is good because the pitching staff has been the issue, right? I mean, that they've got the back of the rotation is not so great, and then the bullpen has struggled as well. So if the guys who are relatively reliable are actually delivering on what they're supposed to deliver on, that's a good sign, and Hamels and Quintana are certainly at the top of the list. Obviously, both of them giving up 0 runs, I don't care who it's against, that's a good sign.
What are your basic philosophical tenets on learning when a guy's just a platoon player versus a guy that can hit against lefties if he's lefty or righty if he's righty? As I'm asking about Albert Almora and Kyle Schwarber, I think there are 2 different things here. Like, we'd like Kyle to hit against left-handers, but if he doesn't play against left-handers, how are you going to know if he can't hit left-handers? Same thing for Albert Almora. When do teams make those distinctions, and how have you kind of, in talking with guys around the game, when do guys make those decisions?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the rest of your skill set, too. You might give somebody the benefit of the doubt if they're scuffling a little bit, but they play superior defense or they're a great base runner or whatever. Schwarber obviously offers really nothing except his bat, and so if he's not hitting a metric ton against whatever side it is, then there's an argument for sitting him. Almora is a little bit more puzzling to me because, you know, Ian Happ was supposed to be his platoon partner. That obviously didn't work out. And, you know, it feels like there's an opportunity there to give him a job. And he does play superior defense, and he does do other things other than hit. I grant you that he's better against left-handers, but it'd be nice to see. So, yeah, I think the additional question, too, is one of development versus winning, that the Cubs are trying to do both. And Dodgers, by the way, too, they've got guys like Alex Verdugo in the lineup. The successful teams are really trying to be young and be good at the same time, and that can cause difficult questions such as what do we do with a Schwarber and Almora, because maybe you'll end up never getting the most out of these guys and you'll wonder what you left on the bone. But at the same time, if the Cubs come back and, you know, win another World Series and they platooned everybody, nobody's complaining.
Major White Sox story has been the response by the Royals to Tim Anderson celebrating a home run, and we've had our usual conversations about stop throwing projectiles at people for being happy about baseball. It really seems it's senseless violence that's going to have a really bad outcome at some point. What do we have to do? What's the cocktail to end this? Is it just Rob Manfred doing a David Stern and saying, you leave the bench, it's 10 games, you throw at a guy like this, it's 20 games? I mean, can it be done that way, or does it have to be organically and gradually with players just stopping this themselves?
Both. Hopefully, I think that it'd be nice if the players stopped doing it. I think one way to do that is to start enforcing it. You know, this gets tricky because sometimes rules only get enforced mid-season, but really you're never supposed to throw at somebody, and it does, you know, pitchers get tossed for this stuff, so it's not really a far step to go from there to suspension. So I think that there should be a point of emphasis there. And, you know, more broadly, it's just crazy because you look at the other sports and it's baseball is the only one where this happens. Maybe 30 years ago, Dale Hunter would spear you or whatever if you celebrated a goal, but we don't really have Dale Hunter anymore, and hockey's a reasonable sport in that respect. And certainly in football, I mean, if you spike the ball or do whatever, nobody's taking out your ACL. In basketball, nobody's submarining you or going for your Achilles if you dunk on somebody and wolf at them. You just have to come correct and do better the next time. You have to beat the guy. And, you know, I think that's what it's all about, is if a pitcher's upset, you have to strike the guy out. And I think that the White Sox-Royals incident was ridiculous because everybody's denying it. The Royals were like, "Oh, it got away from me." Yeah, the guy who hit a home run last time, we threw his bat. That's the one that it happened to get away from you the very next at-bat. I'm not buying it. And moreover, I thought that the Pirates-Reds brawl this season was even dumber because it was Chris Archer who was acting as the police. Have you ever watched Chris Archer pitch?
Uh-huh.
Chris Archer is delightful to pitch, number one, because he's good, and number two, because he's freaking Pascual Perez out there. He's finger-gunning, and he's shooting, and he's, you know, prancing. And whatever. Good, great. I love it. I love that. I love backflips. I love all this stuff. This is sports, man. We've got lots of way more serious things in life. We should be able to have fun with it. The fans should be able to have fun, and yes, the players should be able to have fun.
Yeah, Ned Yost is ridiculous for doing what he's doing and talking the way he's talking. But I wonder this, Jonah, and it's a comment made by a texter the other day, so I'm hesitant to bring it up in the first place, but because it's false flaggy. But yep. Is it possible that Major League Baseball isn't all that, like, as a Rob Manfred led entity, like that side of things? Is it possible that they're not interested in doing anything rule-wise or changing the conversation here because some conversation is better than none conversation?
I will go even more nefarious on you. I don't think Major League Baseball wants to do anything unless that the players agree to something, to make a concession in the collective bargaining agreement.
Ugh.
So let's say that there is a faction of players within the union and they want to, whatever, throw their bats or pump their fist or whatever, the owners aren't going to give them anything. I think I'm taking a Machiavellian view here, but I really believe that the owners don't want to give an inch on anything. And I think that this could be one of them. It's not necessarily a point of emphasis the way, you know, the DH might be or time of game or whatever. But the bottom line here is I think that it's just, if they think that certain players might want certain things, they'll be like, cool, what are you going to give me? I really, really, really think that the owners are just in it to make as much money as possible. And, the flip side of that, of course, is to prevent the players as much as possible from making money. That's how little I trust the current state of baseball.
Where are we on the Vladito arrival clock here as we're all watching the countdown for this dynamic player to make his MLB debut?
I will give you 10 seconds of how the sausage is made. I work for Sportsnet in Canada, and I do TV for them, and I'm a five-hour drive away from Toronto, and we've been going back and forth. Should you come on Tuesday? Should you not come? Is Vlad coming? I don't know. Should we have you on set? Do you want a suit? Do you have a suit? Could you bring a suit? Can Vlad buy you a suit? It's really mania over here, and it's so funny because the Raptors and the Leafs are in the postseason, and they're both very good teams who could actually go far. But I will say the Vladito thing is, you know, it's rested at least a little bit of attention away from those other teams. People are really fired up about it. So it's not an obvious thing as to when you bring him up. Obviously, the year of service time has gone by. The oblique injury probably helps with that. But, you know, the Jays aren't going anywhere. So if you really want to be ridiculous about it, going back to the tactics that teams have used, you could say, all right, let's save him for Super 2. Or screw it, let's just wait until 2020. I just think there might come a point at which fans are going to revolt, because honestly, if he had come up last year, he would have been either the best or the second best hitter on the team, never mind this year. So it's got to happen soon, because at a certain point it reaches the theater of the absurd, and I think fans do start to get upset.
The Dodgers are a fairly stunning ball club, have been for the last couple of years. Their plus 31 run differential is second in baseball, tied with the Mariners and trailing the Tampa Bay Rays, because everybody saw that coming. Their depth is ridiculous. They had Julio Urias, who is, I think, still 19, throw yes. 6 innings and strike out 9. How have they been able to acquire all of these guys? It's just stunning to me.
Well, there's a little bit of, I'm checking my time frame, I believe, I'm pretty sure they've still got a handful of guys who came from the previous regime in baseball, where it was that you could, international signings were based on a different system,
yeah.
And the draft was based on a different system, and the Dodgers took full advantage and they spent money. So that's a little bit of it. I think a little bit of it also is that they can, you know, wait on some guys. They can sort of integrate them into the lineup because they can spend money on other players. I think that's part of it. So they don't necessarily, they didn't need to rush a guy like Urias. They could kind of bounce him around the bullpen, whatever, and slot him in. And you can have 7 good starting pitchers because you're the Dodgers. But I think more than that, let's just give it up for good scouting and player evaluation. At a certain point, we have to acknowledge that the Dodgers might have a gigantic payroll, but they're really good at this. Walker Buehler's really good, and Arias is really good. I really like Verdugo. We mentioned him earlier. He looks like he could be something. He looks like actually what Jock Peterson is now is what Verdugo could become, that left-handed power bat out of the outfield that they've been hoping for. So just a lot there. And we haven't even mentioned some of the scrap heap guys. How about Max Muncy out of nowhere? I mean, he was not a viable major league player at all. And now he's really coming on. Other than Bellinger, he might be the most fearsome bat in that lineup. So there's just a lot there. And it just goes to everything that they do well. This is a well-run organization. I mean, it's well-documented. I think they've got four former GMs, or maybe three now that Anthopoulos went over to Atlanta. That's pretty crazy. You know, it speaks to the acumen that they have. They do a really good job with scouting, and they're run better than most teams in baseball. There's a reason they've made the World Series 2 years in a row.
We're hearing that both Craig Kimbrell and Dallas Keuchel are starting to come off whatever contract demands might have been there and saying, oh, yeah, one-year deal? Yeah, maybe the wives want them out of the house. Maybe this is just the economic reality here. But it kind of sucks. You know, it's just it's amazing how guys are getting squeezed, and it already means they've lost a little bit in this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm having a hard time believing that their agents wouldn't come off of their demands at all. I know Kimbrell allegedly, reportedly wanted something like $100 million, but I find it hard to believe that as we sit here today or yesterday or a week ago, he was still asking for $100 million. I would assume that there was supposed to be some give and take, and maybe the owners just didn't want to do that give and take. And the complicating factor here, of course, is that if a team signs either of these guys, there's a compensation draft pick at stake. And until the next draft goes by, which is in early June, that's still on the table. So I wonder, you know, if you think about Keuchel and Kimbrell and that situation, it might be that a team isn't necessarily going to do it because they won't want to give up a draft pick, especially if it is a one-year deal. Now you're signing somebody, you're giving up a pick for 4 or 5 months of performance. And I'll tell you something else. Dallas Keuchel is exactly the wrong pitcher for 2019. What makes for a pitcher now? Go around the big leagues. It's guys who throw high fastballs, who don't throw a third time through the order. In other words, you're protecting their innings. Maybe they'll go 170 innings for the season, but you know analytically that it's not a good idea to have them go deep into a game. Keuchel specifically specializes in eating innings and throwing sinker balls, which is sinker balls are a terrible idea in the launch angle era in which everybody swings at low pitches and hits them out of the ballpark. He came along at the exact wrong time. If he'd been a free agent right after he won the Cy Young, he would have made $100 million. Now, 20, 30, he's not going to make any kind of big money at all.
It's funny you brought up the idea of a sinker because I was watching Sandy Alcantara of the Marlins pretty closely in the game against the Cubs. He was part of the Ozuna trade. He really looks the part out there. And that sinker was 97, 98, 97, 96, 98 with good movement. And you know what? Guys like Daniel Descalzo were destroying it. All of their hard hits. I mean, it was exactly what you're saying. Do you think that the Cardinals made that trade with the foresight that this kind of pitching profile doesn't lend itself to the way swings are shaped?
Yeah, I think it's entirely possible because if we're going to, you know, if we want to give, let's say, the Astros and the Rays credit, because all they've done over the last few years is groom high fastball guys, four-seam fastballs, no two-seamers. We don't want any of those guys on our staff. Hey, Justin Verlander, you're Justin freaking Verlander, but we're going to change you and we're going to make you throw four-seamers. If we're going to credit them, I think it's not a stretch to credit another team for thinking about it in terms of trades, too. And what's really interesting to me is now you're seeing guys, you know, Verlander's one, but he wasn't a sinkerball specialist. I just wrote a piece today for Sportsnet about Marcus Stroman. Marcus Stroman, other than Keuchel, I believe, threw more sinkers than anybody in baseball. Something like 57, 58% of his pitches were sinkerballs a couple years ago. And that was the year when he was really good, by the way. He had 200 innings pitched. He had the ERA in the low threes. Well, now it's down. His usage is in the 30%, and he's actually throwing his slider more than his sinker because there's a recognition that even though he's a ground ball pitcher and even though it's his bread and butter and he's literally been using that pitch since high school, it's been his best pitch, it doesn't work anymore. So when you've got, you know, veterans who rely on a pitch over and over and even they're changing it up, it is a whole new world out there. It's just not the same baseball that it was even 3 years ago. Really fascinating how quickly the game has changed.
We've got all kinds of rave reviews about Eloy Jimenez's start with the White Sox. Even though the numbers might not pop off the page, the skill set seems there from those who observe it and are much smarter than I am. How soon is too soon to point out a guy's career as being potential for big-time greatness? I mean, he's 17 games in, and Steve Stone has said he could be as good as he wants to be. Like, have we learned even that small sample sizes for minor leaguers have changed where you can put the sights for somebody?
Well, his minor league career is extensive enough that we can extrapolate from those numbers. I mean, this goes back to Bill James and Clay Davenport being able to say, okay, the guy hit 330 with an on base of this and a slugging of this. He was in Double A. He was 19 years old. We adjust for this. We adjust for that. Here are the equivalent numbers. So I don't think it's a stretch to be talking about him as in those terms, because the 17 games are almost immaterial compared to the whatever it was, couple hundred
right.
that he had in the minor league. So, you know, there is something there, and the potential is certainly there. And age is a factor, too. We just cannot overlook it. If you break into the big leagues and you're really good, but you're 26 years old, you know, your tail's probably not going to be as long. Maybe you'll be good for a couple years, but it's not going to go as well. Just being precocious, getting to the big leagues relatively quickly and being able to do things right away, you know, hit the ground running, those are all really good signs. Acuna was that way. Juan Soto was that way, certainly. Trout had that brief cameo, then he was good right away. Harper was good right away. These are the guys who become stars. So Jimenez, not quite as young as those guys, but still precocious enough and still good enough pretty quickly that there could be something there. It's a very, very big bat, and I think as long as his defense plays well enough in the outfield, yeah, he can absolutely be a star.
So I've been wondering this, Jonah, as the sun sets tonight, is there anything unique to a Quebecois Passover Seder?
No, I don't know if this is well known, but Montreal might still be true. It has been true for a long, or was true for a long time, has the second largest Jewish community outside of Israel. Only New York has a bigger one. It's huge here. So it's not Quebecois exactly. It's more that the people who would have gone to New York, you know, in the 40s or the 50s or whatever, yep. they landed here. So it's a very rich community, and it'll be a full house here, that's for sure. And I'll be leading in both Hebrew and English. I get to break out my Hebrew.
Really?
Well, yes, indeed. I still have some of that left in my repertoire.
That's big time. It's funny you bring that up, too, because you see some people ended up in New York. The way I learned about sort of the American-Canadian bifurcation of some of these communities was that I had my family, my paternal side is all from Omaha, Nebraska, and found out later, and it was only because a listener to the show heard me talking about some family function in Omaha, heard a last name, sent me a note and said, by the way, is there somebody with the last name of this? And we did a bunch of geography, and it turns out we were related
wow.
distantly because his family settled in Winnipeg. And apparently,
wow, Winnipeg, really?
Apparently there was a group from a certain area near what is now the border of Poland, somewhere else in like eastern Poland, that when they arrived, that area, that flat sort of rural farming area, it drew that community. They split equally in between when they came over in the early 1900s, in between Omaha and Winnipeg. I guess that's something similar. The big city folk were more likely to gravitate to New York and Montreal.
I completely buy that. It completely makes sense. I will say my grandparents were small town folks and they ended up here. But, you know, for the most part, the Canada does have a community for sure. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't think there'll be too much French at the table, but we will try to do some Hebrew.
Sounds good. Have a happy and healthy holiday, Jonah. Thanks.
Same to you guys.
Jonah Carey of The Athletic, Sportsnet, and The Opener podcast.
I didn't know any of that.
What?
The immigration thing, splitting for small towns and splitting for big cities. I didn't know that Montreal had a big Jewish community at all.
Oh, there is a delicatessen there called Schwartz's. And they call it smoked meat. It's pastrami, but they don't call it pastrami.
Why?
They call it smoked meat, and you can't get it in the United States for whatever
reason.
That's
how you know it's good.
Well, when I asked why, they're like, yeah, it's too carcinogenic.
It's got all the cancer. We just load this puppy up with cancer.
There's something about the way they smoke it that the U.S.
And did you want extra cancer sauce on the side?
Right. No, but you order it. Lean, medium, or fatty, and like the hardcore pros order it fatty.
Of course,
you don't want the lean because the flavor is in the fat. And yeah, but if you're ever in Montreal, If you're ever in Montreal, Schwartz's is the joint. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
I went to Montreal once. Really enjoyed my time there. They let 18-year-olds drink, so that was a fun time for me.
Right, because they're smart enough to know it doesn't really matter all that much. They demystify the whole thing. The segment's brought to you by Chicagoland Papa John's. Chicagoland Papa John's is offering free pizza this weekend. Buy one pizza at regular price. Get a second pizza of equal or less value for free. Use promo code FREEPIZZADAY on the Papa John's app or online at papajohns.com. That's promo code FREEPIZZADAY. Kyle Hendricks is starting today.
That he is.
And there's a piece of all places, a freelance piece in Forbes talking about some of what's going on with him and what he's got to fix, because it's been bad.
No, there has to be some settling down for Kyle Hendricks. I was encouraged some by what Jed Hoyer had to say with the morning show about Kyle just the other day. We played some of that for you yesterday. And you know, you take a look at this piece, and really, I think it's probably more optimistic than not for one of the big-time starters in the Cubs rotation. That's where we're headed next. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
Bottom of the hour is brought to you by Northwestern Football. Join Coach Fitz and the Big Ten West Division and Holiday Bowl champions at Ryan Field this fall when they host Ohio State, Iowa, Michigan State, and more. Season tickets on sale now at nusports.com. It's Forbes magazine, of all places. Occasionally will do some, they have some freelance sports stuff. And this was an interesting breakdown of what's going on with Kyle Hendricks by a writer named Ryan Davis. And Hendricks realizes that there's, with him always, movement issues and command issues. We had speculated that maybe that his two-seamer and changeup weren't moving because of what's going on with the slippery baseball right now. Not slippery out of the hand, but slippery through the air. Although Noah Syndergaard is on record saying that the ball, what do you say, feels like an ice cube?
Like an ice cube. Like you've ever watched a dog trying to pick up an ice cube. That's what it felt like to him.
His velocity, though, Hendricks's, is down. The 85.8 miles an hour that he averaged on his two-seamer against the Angels was his lowest in any individual game going back to August of 2017.
That's a long ways.
That's when he was dealing with some release point issues that led to diminished velocity. Overall, his 86.2 average this season falls short of last year's 87.1, well short of the 88 average of just a few years ago. But velocity loss on its own is something Hendricks believes he can work through. In 2017, he went to what was then the disabled list with tendonitis in his pitching hand in June. When he returned in July, he finished up with a 2.19 ERA over his final 13 starts as his velocity ticked up during that stretch, averaging, though, just 86.1. Against the Angels, Hendricks went primarily with his two-seamer and changeup, the four-seam fastball in the periphery. An interesting trend this season is that Hendricks has hardly used his curveball. A 4.8% rate so far. And I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, that when we were in Mesa, he said he was going to use it more, did he not?
He did.
Didn't he?
He did say he wanted it. Not a ton.
But more.
He specified, but more. If you look at a baseball, which I love for charting pitches, it's great to look at after a start, make sure you saw what you think you saw. Yeah, the changeups are down probably about 6 or 7 changeups a game, it feels like.
Oh, there's more data here when you're talking about the changeup.
I'm sorry, curves.
Oh, the curve you're saying.
Yeah.
But the changeup has not been generating swings and misses. His career whiff percentage is well over 20% prior to this year. And this year, it's almost half that, an 11.2% rate with his changeup. It's only 3 starts, and he tends to pitch well after getting the first 3 out of the way. But there's something unsettling about what's going on here.
Well, remember, we went through this, I think it was season before last, where Hendricks was getting roughed up for a start or 2 or 3 or something like that. It was kind of a rough start. It was before his hand tendonitis thing, if I recall correctly. And guys were just putting away his changeup. It was not even swinging at it because it wasn't something they could hit. And it was out of the strike zone. And at the time, I think this was in 16, where you had a better fly ball, you had a better baseball that flew through the air as it flew through the air in the first half. They were just pounding into the ground for ground ball outs. They were trying to find that fastball and eat off that thing. They put the changeup away completely. So throwing that for strikes became more difficult. Mechanically speaking, Hoyer talked about it, Kyle has talked about it, and this piece kind of talks about it too. He finds some of his velocity, maybe more than other starters, through good, solid mechanics, not necessarily through like this dead arm stuff or feeling healthy, kind of things like that. You want him to be 100%, but I have some faith that Kyle Hendricks can get the velocity back. Whether or not the ball is going to do what he's asking it to, it's a fair question.
If nothing less, he's earned the benefit of the doubt because he's gone through difficult stretches before and recovered.
Absolutely.
We've seen it happen. Jay and Schaumburg, you're on Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Hey, what's up, fellas?
What's up, Jay?
So I want to start by saying that I completely agree. There should be no reason for any pitcher to throw a ball at anybody in the game. And I also believe that players, after hitting a home run, should be able to bat flip or celebrate. Mm-hmm. But I just want to challenge you guys that what Tim Anderson did was not celebrating. And when a football player sacks a quarterback and gets in his face or stands over him, or somebody does a dunk in a basketball game and stands over him or points his finger at him, they're issued technical fouls and flags. And I just think that there should be a warning for something like that, because I don't think that was really truly celebrating if you go back and look at it.
We've How come? A lot of what did he do that was over a line for you?
Well, I won't say it was over the line, but when you see normal bat flips, what he did was it looked angry. He threw it down in anger and he started yelling.
Well,
so
no,
I mean, don't call that celebrating.
He chucked it at his own dugout and was screaming, "Let's go," and probably other words that I can't say.
Yeah, let's
effing
go.
And just being really happy about things. I don't really see a whole lot of anger in there. Did you?
I mean, I'm just saying, when you compare that to, like I said, a basketball player dunking on somebody and doing that same thing, or a football player doing that,
but he didn't,
they're issued
but
things.
He didn't but taunt
why,
anybody.
Why, like, compare it to other sports? Why not just, I mean, why should we compare bat flip to bat flip? Why should we go on a case-by-case basis? Like, it just doesn't seem like that's something that can hurt anyone.
Yeah, what looked angry
and a
hit-by-pitch
can, you know?
Well, when you say what looked angry to me, it didn't look celebrating. Maybe angry is not the right word, but it just didn't look like celebrating. It didn't look like celebrating your achievement of hitting the ball into the stand.
What did it look like he was doing?
It looked like he was showing up the other team.
See, the problem I have...
when those things happen, you're issued some type of warning or technical or flag.
Yeah, the problem I have with that, Jay, though, is this. Like, at the end of that whole fight, Joe West tossed Tim Anderson for whatever reason. And it's probably because... What's that?
Which was wrong.
Right, but when you leave it up to a warning like that, like if we do what you're talking about, like umpires will issue warnings or whatever, the guy who's going to issue the warning is Joe West at the end of the day, and he was wrong to toss Tim Anderson out, and he'll likely be wrong to issue warnings to whatever player is going to bat flip angrily or whatever. You're just letting the same guys. You would just be letting the same guys who have problems with the way people want to play baseball now mitigate some sort of arbitrary rule about what is and isn't enough or not enough celebrating.
See, here's the problem with the premise,
though.
I do
agree. It would be really, really hard to police what is celebrating and what is not. But I'm tired of looking at the fights in baseball. It's so ridiculous.
I absolutely 100% agree with that. I just think that, Jay, the fact that he threw the bat toward his own dugout and yelled toward his own dugout is a counter-argument for anything close to taunting.
All right, well, I appreciate that, fellas. I just wanted to get your opinion.
Fair enough,
you got
Jay.
It, Jay.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
I get it. I mean, I understand the warning idea of things. It's probably a better way to deal with it than just letting a pitcher hit somebody. It's the middle ground, that gray area. Can I read you something real quickly here? I do not want to end the show today without mentioning this. This is a tweet from Ian Rappaport, our guy, Thursday Dude.
Okay.
Raiders coach John Gruden and GM Mike Mayock sent their scouts home for the weekend, and they are not expected to return by draft time. The belief is they don't know who to trust and wanted to clear the room.
Oh, God. Wait, trust with what or for what?
I don't know, man.
Trust
lunch
how?
Orders or draft picks or leaking or something.
They
I don't know.
Draft based off the NFL.com profile.
That is amazing. That is absolutely beautiful.
They're purging their coaching staff because they don't trust them?
In a draft where they traded everyone to get as many draft picks as they possibly could to rebuild. And, you know, when I gave you the list of excuses that John Gruden can map out over the next 8 years of his 10-year contract to get another 10-year contract so he never has to prove anything, I did not expect Game
Didn't
of
the, like Russia.
I did not expect like a red wedding of your own scouts, removing them from the room, and just you and Mike Mayock sitting down without pants and with sandwiches, going over. I like this guy and I like that guy.
John,
that's how we're
Oakland,
gonna draft.
Call. Who's your guy that next week?
He's gonna keep calling under different names.
This is John from Oak Town,
or wherever.
This is John. I got to tell you, I got another question for you.
What do you
think
guy. About this guy?
I got another guy for you. This segment is brought to you by Chicagoland Papa John's. Chicagoland Papa John's is offering free pizza this weekend. Buy one pizza at regular price, get a second pizza of equal or less value for free. Use promo code FREEPIZZADAY on the Papa John's app or online at papajohns.com. That is promo code FREEPIZZADAY. A lot of people asking about who's your guy. Oh, Oh, it's coming your way.
Starts on Monday.
Starts on Monday. It's going to be all week next week because we don't have to worry about the first round or the second round.
All week long.
All week long. We can just keep doing it as the Bears find guys. We're going to bring you all the information. We're going to do our draft homework together. And up next, we've got a special guest who's going to join the Bernstein and McKnight Show on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.